Hello, everyone, and welcome to Classic Gaming Today, where we take a look at the gaming experiences of the past through the eyes of the present. I'm your host, Tony, and today we're going to look at Super Ghouls and Ghosts, a side-scrolling platform title developed and published by Capcom and released for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System back in 1991. We're going to talk about that game in just a couple minutes, but first, as is usual, just a little bit of housekeeping up front. This is episode number 82. I'm excited to be here. I hope all of you are as well. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle at ClassicGamingT. I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. We do weekly gaming challenges. We have great discussions. We have prizes and rewards and things like that. I highly encourage you all to check it out. I also highly encourage you to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/classicgamingtoday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including a Patreon-exclusive bi-weekly podcast expansion pack, patreon.com/classicgamingtoday is where it's at. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our Pantheon patrons. They are ISO, Rich Senewald, David Morton, Sam Twardowski, Sean Marshall, and Steve Novoselic. Thank you guys for supporting the show. Thank you all for supporting the show, whether you contribute monetarily or simply listen on a regular basis. I truly do appreciate all of the support. For anyone who may be new, welcome. I just like to give a brief overview of the anatomy of an episode because, for the most part, all of our episodes follow a very similar format and structure. We will always start by talking about the history of the game in question, the historical context, how was the game made, why was the game made, and then we move into a pseudo-review kind of section. And I say pseudo-review because it's not like we assign a numerical ranking or star count or anything like that, but we do talk about every single game from several different perspectives. We take a look at the graphics. How does the game look? The sound and music. How does the game sound? The narrative and or story, if the game has one. Playability and controls and overall feel. What does it feel like to play the game today versus when it was released 20, 30, maybe even 40 plus years ago? We do all of that to reach a verdict as far as how well the game holds up today. And to do that, we assign each game to one of several categories. At the very top of our list is the Pantheon of Classic Gaming. If a game reaches the Pantheon, you know it is that darn good. It is a certifiable classic. You should go out of your way to play those games today. Just beyond the Pantheon are our golden oldies. These are still really good games. I still highly recommend you play them, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game exists. By all means, you should have a good time. They're not quite Pantheon level, but they are still really good experiences, and I still highly recommend you play them today. Beyond the golden oldies, we reach our mediocre mentions. This is where we start getting into the realm of games that I cannot recommend to the broad population. They might have aged a little bit, might have had a couple of issues to begin with. You may still have a good time, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game lives. By all means, go for it. But I cannot recommend these games to the broad gaming population. And then beyond the mediocre mentions, we reach the footnotes. These are the games that are best left in the annals of history. I have played them, so you don't have to. I cannot recommend anyone play these titles today. They have either aged incredibly poorly, or they may not have been all that great to begin with. With that out of the way, we're going to start talking about the game of the day. That is Super Ghouls and Ghosts. Super Ghouls and Ghosts is a side-scrolling action platform title developed and published by Capcom and released for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System back in 1991. Before we can talk about Super Ghouls and Ghosts, we need to go back and talk about its predecessors, which means we need to talk about the arcade classics Ghosts and Goblins and ghouls and ghosts. And to do that, we need to discuss the father of the entire series, Tokuro Fujiwara. Longtime listeners may recall that we have talked about Tokuro Fujiwara before, as he would become one of the more influential figures in video game history, having contributed to the success of such classics as Bionic Commando and the Mega Man series, with perhaps his biggest claim to fame being the production of the original Resident Evil for the Sony PlayStation, which was itself born out of Fujiwara's desire to effectively remake his Japan-exclusive Famicom role-playing game, Sweet Home. Back in 1982, though, Fujiwara was simply a recent college graduate on the search for a job. While attending the Osaka Designers College in Osaka, Japan, a job recruiter for video game company Konami visited the campus, as job recruiters are apt to do with local colleges and universities. At the time, Konami was hiring for a project planning role, a job that appealed to Fujiwara for a few different reasons. For one, the pay was good, which is obviously a pretty big consideration when seeking out employment. Another appealing aspect of the role was the fact that project planning was an area that interested Fujiwara, and he believed he could put his education to good use in the role. And finally, Konami's headquarters was geographically close to Fujiwara's home, meaning his daily commute could be minimized, which he appreciated. He ended up applying for the job and received an offer, which is what led to Fujiwara joining Konami in 1982. The observant amongst you might have noticed that none of the reasons that played into Fujiwara's decision had anything to do with the fact that Konami was a fairly big player in the video game industry, and for good reason. Fujiwara had little interest in video games at the time, and in fact, he didn't know anything about the company at the point that he joined it. He simply knew he was getting a job that sounded interesting to him, and that was good enough. It wouldn't take long, though, before Fujiwara had an opportunity to begin working on his first game, the arcade shooter Puyan, which would release in 1982. While Fujiwara wouldn't begin designing that game from scratch, as there were already certain design elements in place, like the overall story, which was actually based on the Three Little Pigs nursery rhyme, and the main character and general concept for the game were already developed, he would, though, be responsible for integrating all of the individual pieces and bringing the title to life. While Puyan is certainly known in the classic arcade community, and it was included in the Konami Arcade Classics collection released on the Sony PlayStation years later, I would venture a guess that this title is a bit less well-known amongst the broader gaming community than Fujiwara's later efforts. Regardless, Fujiwara's first game would be a moderate success, which is what led to him acting as the director for Konami's next title, Rock and Rope, which was itself an early prototype for the type of gameplay that would become popularized in his later game, Bionic Commando. Rock and Rope would become a classic, and would end up being recognized amongst other early Konami titles like Frogger and Scramble as a driving force behind the company's early arcade success. With Fujiwara continuing to grow his skill set, it wasn't long before other companies began to take notice, with one of those being the newly formed organization Capsule Computers, which you might know by its eventual concatenated and abbreviated name, Capcom. Shortly after its formation, Capcom was looking to enter the video arcade industry, and to do that, they needed to bring on some talented game designers, which is what led to them recruiting a number of individuals from Konami to join their company. One of those individuals, you probably guessed, was Fujiwara, who ended up joining Capcom in 1983 as the lead of one of three development groups across the entire company, the other two being led by Takashi Nishiyama, the eventual creator of side-scrolling beat-em-ups like Kung Fu Master and Street Fighter, and Yoshiki Okamoto, the eventual creator of such titles as 1942, Final Fight, and Street Fighter II. Between those three divisions, Capcom would begin taking the video game and arcade industry by storm, as each lead designer started churning out a steady stream of hits that served to earn Capcom a reputation for delivering quality arcade experiences. While the sheer volume of classics created by these three groups is well beyond the scope of this episode, one 1985 release title we absolutely do need to discuss, and that is, of course, Fujiwara's arcade hit, Ghosts and Goblins. Ghosts and Goblins tells the story of Sir Arthur, an armor-clad knight with an interesting under-apparel wardrobe who is tasked with saving a kidnapped princess while needing to fight across a zombie, ghost, and goblin-infested countryside. As players make their way through the game's collection of levels, they need to defeat these enemies, all the while avoiding taking damage wherever possible, because in this game, two hits kill. It only takes one hit to remove all of Arthur's armor, with any subsequent hit while Arthur is solely wearing his iconic strawberry patterned underwear, resulting in instant death. And by the way, yes, I said strawberry patterned underwear, because that's exactly what it was. Fujiwara was asked in a prior interview about the underwear's design, which many believed to have been covered by hearts. But it turns out, those heart-looking pictures were actually strawberries, and the underwear itself was a gift from the princess in honor of Arthur's prior heroic exploits. Fujiwara explains, and I quote, "Arthur has this air of ruggedness when he has his armor on, but on the inside, he gets a little fancy and wears his favorite boxers." Fruity underwear aside, Ghosts and Goblins, like many arcade titles of the time, was a decidedly difficult experience, as the goal of arcade games was, ultimately, to make a ton of money one quarter at a time. Because most arcade titles were designed to be relatively short experiences, the only way they could extend gameplay and sales was to make those games challenging, and here, Fujiwara actually took things a step further than most. Even amongst its arcade peers, Ghosts and Goblins is widely considered to be one of the hardest games ever created, and for good reason. The game, from the very beginning, was intended to be devilishly difficult, and Fujiwara actually had that as one of his design goals when he sat down to begin making the game. Unlike many games, though, Fujiwara looked at high difficulty as a means to instill a sense of achievement in gamers when they eventually conquer the challenges put before them. While his game is certainly difficult, it was not arbitrarily so. Fujiwara always intended players to eventually be able to beat Ghosts and Goblins. You'd just have to get pretty proficient at the game in order to stand a chance at reaching that goal. And that proficiency was something Fujiwara constantly tested while doing playtests for the game. He relayed a story in a prior interview where he would conduct testing at various locations while he was in the midst of creating Ghosts and Goblins, and he would routinely observe players as they played the title. Fujiwara noted that he was particularly interested in finding sections that players appeared to be getting past too easily, because, well, he knew those were the sections that he would have to revisit and add some additional challenge to. Seriously, he actively seeked out sections of the game that players were getting past without much difficulty, and intentionally made those sections harder. That sounds kind of mean in retrospect, but in all fairness, Fujiwara recognized that too much difficulty wouldn't be good either, as if players hit too hard of a brick wall, they could simply walk away and stop playing, which wouldn't have been good for sales or his game's potential legacy. Luckily for all, Fujiwara was able to strike a balance between the game's somewhat brutal difficulty and player engagement, which is what drove Ghosts and Goblins to become a critically praised title, both in arcades, where it would be one of the top-grossing arcade games in both 1985 and 1986, as well as its eventual Nintendo Entertainment System, or NES, port, which would go on to sell over 1.5 million copies, and would be named by several publications as the best arcade port of the year in 1986, as well as retrospectively being named one of the best NES titles of all time. To say Ghosts and Goblins was a success would be an understatement, and with such success, it is not surprising that work would begin on a sequel. That follow-up, entitled Ghouls and Ghosts, would represent Fujiwara's second game in the Ghosts and Goblins series, and would release in arcades in 1988, with numerous home ports following, with perhaps the most significant port being the Sega Genesis version of the title, which, interestingly, has its own story that we need to dive into. In 1988, arcades were still the place to be if you were looking for the highest quality graphics and audio gaming experiences, as arcade cabinets often had dedicated hardware that cost thousands of dollars, in comparison to the home console market where systems were designed to hit a much lower price point with decidedly less powerful hardware. Even in the home computer market, which was a much more expensive industry than video game consoles, graphics and audio power weren't nearly as pervasive, as computers were still thought of primarily as productivity devices, not gaming platforms. Now, obviously, this is a bit of a generalization, as there were many computer games across a number of different platforms, including MS-DOS, Amiga, Commodore, and Apple, just to name a few, all of which had different audio and graphics capabilities. But regardless, arcades were still the kings and queens of the video game industry, at least if you wanted to get the highest quality visuals and the most pulse-pounding audio. Capcom, in an effort to continue to push the state-of-the-art in arcade game design, created the CP System Arcade Board in 1988, a collection of hardware that would be the most powerful arcade system created by Capcom to date. This board would end up servicing a number of arcade titles across Capcom's game catalog over the years that would follow, and for good reason. The CP System was one of the first arcade boards that was designed to support multiple games with a common set of hardware, with only the individual game's code, instructions, graphics, and audio changing from one release to the next. Up to this point, most traditional arcade hardware was designed specifically for the game it was attempting to play. The CP System was designed to be more console-centric, meaning there was a standard set of hardware that all games could utilize, rather than custom hardware needing to be developed for each game individually. While the games themselves still came on chips instead of cartridges, the CP System was a big step towards delivering common arcade hardware for multiple games, a method of arcade development that would remain popular in the arcade space for years to come. Ghouls and Ghosts was one of the first games to be designed for Capcom's CP System, which meant that it was effectively one of the prettiest, most cutting-edge games released in 1988, a fact that arcade-goers welcomed with open arms, as the title would become one of the highest-grossing arcade titles of the year. Its Sega Genesis port, however, would be even more impressive, as it represented an incredibly faithful rendition of the arcade original, a feat that was thought impossible by many around this time. One reason for that port's success is the fact that it was designed for the Sega Genesis, a 16-bit console that was dramatically more powerful than the standard 8-bit consoles of the time. But another reason the port was so successful is that it was developed by Sega Rockstar programmer Yuji Naka. We've talked about Naka's gaming exploits before, specifically during our episode on Sonic the Hedgehog, which at this point was still a few years away from being developed. Back in the late 80s, though, Naka was still a relatively new, albeit highly skilled, programmer at Sega, and it would be a chance encounter at Japan's 1988 Amusement Machines Show, a convention highlighting the best of the best in arcade technology, that would drive Naka to want to port Ghouls and Ghosts to the recently released Sega Genesis console. When Naka attended the Amusement Machines Show, he came upon the arcade version of Ghouls and Ghosts, and he was absolutely stunned at the game's quality, including the smoothness with which the game's main character, Sir Arthur, was able to traverse sloped floors. The majority of platform titles released up to that point used flat surfaces for players to adventure on, a decision driven by the technology available at the time. Ghouls and Ghosts featured environments that were decidedly not flat, and Naka was incredibly impressed by what he saw, so much so that he developed a strong desire to port the game to the Sega Genesis. With that desire in his heart, he went off to find Capcom and pitch the concept of a port, which the company agreed to, providing Naka with the source code and basically saying, good luck. This led Naka to begin experimenting with the Sega Genesis, and over a period of just 5 months, he had succeeded in porting an incredibly faithful version of the game to the Genesis, complete with sloped floors, high-quality graphical effects, and gameplay that had, up to this point, been the domain of arcades, not home consoles. Naka's port was so close to the arcade original that he intentionally replicated the bugs that had previously existed in the arcade game. Intentionally introduced bugs just to be as faithful as possible. Naka's goal was to deliver a true arcade experience at home, and that is exactly what he was able to do, with Ghouls and Ghosts for the Sega Genesis becoming one of the most critically acclaimed titles of the year, with some publications even naming the title Game of the Year for 1989. The port was so good, in fact, that Fujiwara himself jokingly claimed he was irritated by the quality, indicating the fact that Naka was able to achieve those results in just 5 months was, in his words, not cool. Before we move on, I should mention that during his work on the port for the title, Naka experimented with a number of different techniques for creating sloped floors on the Sega Genesis console, and eventually succeeded in creating a fully realized 360-degree loop, a graphics and gameplay trick that he would keep in his back pocket for a couple of years, eventually resurrecting that code for use in Sonic the Hedgehog in 1991. I never realized that Ghouls and Ghosts had some degree of relationship to Sonic, and that was a fact that I found pretty interesting. Anyway, Ghouls and Ghosts was another hit for Fujiwara and the Capcom team, and with the introduction of Nintendo's Super Nintendo Entertainment System in late 1990, Fujiwara and Capcom saw a new opportunity. What if, rather than developing the next Ghosts and Goblins game for the arcade, they could instead create a home console exclusive experience, using the power of the Super Nintendo to deliver an arcade-like experience at home, leveraging the specific aspects of the console to create something truly unique? That idea sounded pretty great to all involved, which is what led to the creation of Super Ghouls and Ghosts in 1991. Interestingly, despite the name of the title suggesting that it was an enhanced version of the original Ghouls and Ghosts, Super Ghouls and Ghosts was an entirely brand new experience, aside from the very first stage, which was inspired by the arcade original. Bringing Super Ghouls and Ghosts to life would fall to designer Tetsuya Minami, with Fujiwara having been promoted to be the producer for the title, and still ultimately responsible for oversight for the overall creation of the game. Up to this point, Minami had never led a project, with his prior work being primarily focused on developing art for home ports of various Capcom titles, including Final Fight and Street Fighter II. With Super Ghouls and Ghosts, Minami would be responsible for leading a 50-person team to develop the title, having been brought in to lead the effort pretty early on in the development timeline, with only a single level created at the point Minami joined the team. From that point on, Minami faced numerous challenges, including project delays, team turnover, and other issues that resulted in an incredibly tumultuous development cycle for the game. After nearly 2 years in development, the game was finally ready for release, though not before needing to remake the master version of the game's code several times in the weeks immediately preceding the game's completion, something that was nearly unheard of in most successful game releases. With so much churn during the development process, you might assume that Super Ghouls and Ghosts would be destined to failure, though that assumption could not be further from the truth. Super Ghouls and Ghosts would release in 1991 to stellar reviews across a number of different critical publications, where many critics praised the game's graphics, gameplay, and music, while at the same time claiming that the game was one of the hardest experiences you could possibly play on the Super Nintendo, with many suggesting the game was as unforgiving as it comes, a true test of your video game playing prowess. Hard games on a Nintendo system were pretty much par for the course around this time, though unlike many of those Nintendo hard experiences, Super Ghouls and Ghosts was praised for the fact that its challenge, while significant, never felt unfair. Instead, it felt like an obstacle to be overcome, and many related that upon surmounting that obstacle, they felt such an intense feeling of achievement that it made the entire experience worthwhile, a sentiment that Fujiwara had always strived to include in the Ghosts and Goblins series all the way from the very first title. Super Ghouls and Ghosts would also become a commercial success, with over 1 million copies of the game sold over the course of its lifetime. It would end up being ported to the Game Boy Advance in 2002, and would be included in a number of Capcom game compilation packages over the years, was one of the included featured titles in the Super NES Classic Mini Console in 2017, and would also grace a number of online platforms as well, like the Wii, Wii U, and new Nintendo 3DS Virtual Console storefronts, in addition to the Nintendo Switch online service. Today, Super Ghouls and Ghosts remains easily playable across a number of platforms, allowing players around the world the opportunity to control Sir Arthur in his third adventure, itself representing the first time a Ghosts and Goblins game originated on a home console as opposed to an arcade cabinet. With that success, Tetsuya Minami would gain recognition for his work, and would be offered the opportunity to lead future efforts at Capcom, while Fujiwara's star continued to rise, leading to him continuing to act as a producer for a number of Capcom's most well-liked future releases, including, like we mentioned, Resident Evil. For more info on that one, by the way, check out our episode on Resident Evil from last year. Anyway, after the release of Super Ghouls and Ghosts, the mainline Ghosts and Goblins series would fall by the wayside just a little bit, with only revisits of the original game gracing more modern systems over the years. These reimaginings include Ultimate Ghosts and Goblins for the Sony PlayStation Portable System in 2006, as well as Ghosts and Goblins Resurrection, a modern title released in 2021 for pretty much every current console and computer platform. Those titles are notable for the fact that longtime producer Fujiwara remained in charge of both efforts, ensuring that each reimagining maintained the same feeling, structure, and gameplay as the original series. While the Ghosts and Goblins series might not have seen many new releases over the years, there were several offshoot series that received some degree of attention, with perhaps the most notable being the Gargoyles Quest series. Though even that three-game collection, by the way, hasn't seen a new entry since 1994. Despite the relative scarcity of Ghosts and Goblins mainline games, there were a number of attempts to release new titles from more modern systems following Super Ghouls and Ghosts, with PlayStation, Nintendo 64, GameCube, PlayStation 2, and Xbox titles all in development at some point, all of which were ultimately canceled prior to release. Regardless, the Ghosts and Goblins series, and Super Ghouls and Ghosts in particular, deserves your attention. As what many consider to be the best title in the series, Super Ghouls and Ghosts succeeded in creating an arcade-like experience exclusively for the home market, and in the process, introduced Super Nintendo players around the world to what would widely be considered the hardest game to grace Nintendo's 16-bit platform. We'll get into my opinions on that claim in a few minutes, but suffice it to say, the game is certainly not a cakewalk. What it is, though, is a well-crafted experience that has been entertaining players for over 30 years, and as such, is a game that both deserves to be remembered and has earned its spot as one of the most challenging and engaging video games of all time. We are now going to shift to start talking about what it feels like to play Super Ghouls and Ghosts today versus when it was released over 30 years ago. Before we get started, though, I want to acknowledge that Super Ghouls and Ghosts, along with the rest of the Ghosts and Goblins series, is most often discussed in relation to the level of difficulty each title presents. And certainly, Super Ghouls and Ghosts is a challenging title, and we will talk about my opinion on the game's challenge in just a little bit. But simply labeling the game as a hard, challenging experience is a bit reductive. While the challenge is absolutely a core part of the experience, there is a lot more to Super Ghouls and Ghosts than merely its difficulty. So let's talk about the overall structure of the game. Super Ghouls and Ghosts, like many side-scrolling action platformers, consists of a series of levels that you need to make your way through, navigating obstacles, defeating enemies, conquering bosses, and using the environment and any items you pick up to your advantage. Taken at face value alone, Super Ghouls and Ghosts sounds like any number of platform titles you may have experienced in the past. But in actuality, the game is fairly unique in the action platform space, and in fact does a lot of things differently than its peers. For one, Super Ghouls and Ghosts is, generally speaking, a slower-paced experience than what you might be used to or expecting. You are not expected to waltz through these levels at a breakneck speed, or even at a brisk walk kind of pace. Instead, most levels will have you inching forward little by little, making steady progress along the way. Because the game is designed to constantly throw enemies at you, with many levels spawning a random assortment of bad guys to both slow down the pace of gameplay, while at the same time forcing you to strategize about how to proceed forward. And you will, in fact, have to strategize on the best way to progress through a level, because the life system, so to speak, in this game is pretty darn unforgiving. By default, you start each stage with a suit of silver armor, and assuming you don't pick up any power-ups, you can take 2 hits before you die. The first hit will remove your silver armor, forcing you to navigate the level in your underwear, while the second hit will kill you, depleting one of your lives. Now, you can in fact obtain armor power-ups that allow your silver armor to turn green and eventually gold, and you can also eventually pick up a shield to augment that armor. But interestingly, those additional armor power-ups don't actually increase your defensive capabilities. Meaning, if you get hit while wearing green or gold armor, the effect is the same as if you were wearing silver armor. One hit reduces you to your underwear, regardless of how many armor power-ups you may have picked up, and the next hit will kill you. So, you might be asking, why pick up armor power-ups if they give you no defensive capabilities? Well, that's because the armor power-ups do have an impact on your weapon powers, which are represented by a variety of different weapon types that you can pick up throughout your adventure, such as crossbows, lances, axes, knives, and torches. Each of those weapons has a default attack that gets augmented if you pick up various armor upgrades, which means it does behoove you to bolster your armor whenever possible. As an example, if you're using the crossbow, by default, you'll shoot a series of angled projectiles in the direction you're facing. If you have the green armor power-up, however, your projectiles become homing orbs, which will seek out enemies regardless of how you shoot your weapon. If you have the golden armor power-up, you'll also gain the ability to charge your weapon up to unleash a special ability, in addition to whatever weapon upgrade the green armor power-up previously provided. In this way, the weapon system in the game is fairly robust, and based on the unique combination of weapon and armor level, you can have dramatically different gameplay experiences as you make your way through each level. Though, while each weapon is technically usable, in that they all do something when you press your attack button, not every weapon is equally good, and in fact, from my perspective, there are really only 2 weapons that have any degree of usability throughout the majority of the game. Those being the knife and the crossbow. Now, I have to preface this by saying, when I first started playing the game, the knife was my go-to weapon almost exclusively, and I absolutely hated anything else, including the crossbow. But I eventually came around to the benefits of the crossbow, because its angled shots and homing shots, if powered up, can hit certain enemies that are incredibly challenging to hit if using the more straightforward shooting knives, like the absolutely brutal flying red devils that you eventually face in pretty large quantities later in your adventure. I have tried a bunch of different weapon combinations to take them out, and the conclusion I arrived at was that the crossbow provides the most overall usability throughout the majority of situations you'll face in the game. The knife is a close second, but the fact that it shoots only in a straight line makes its use more limited against flying enemies like the Red Devils. Every other weapon in the game, from my perspective, is so much worse than the crossbow and the knife that they almost don't enter into the conversation at all. I'm sure there are people out there that might love one of the other weapons, but for me, they just don't provide enough benefit to outweigh all of their downsides. And actually, at this point, I should probably talk about the item system itself, because I haven't really mentioned how you pick up items or how that overall armor upgrade system works. Every usable item in the game, meaning any armor upgrades and every weapon, is accessible by finding various treasure chests that are hidden throughout each level. Rather than having each treasure chest contain a random item, though, there is a definite progression to the chests that exist in each level. The first chest you encounter in any level will contain a random weapon. Now, regardless of whether you have your favorite weapon already equipped or not, you should strive to always access that first chest, because doing so moves the next chest you find to the next step in the overall item progression for the level. Assuming you do access that first chest, which does not mean you need to pick up the item, you just need to access the chest. The next chest you find will contain green armor, which is your first level of armor power-up, with the following chest being golden armor and finally a shield. I should mention, by the way, that the shield appears to be a relatively fickle upgrade, and that I could have sworn I saw it absorb a projectile hit without impacting the rest of my armor, but in other instances, it acts as any other armor upgrade, meaning you get hit, you get reduced to your underwear. Even the game manual indicates that the shield should block 3 shots before being ruined, but it's unclear to me exactly what constitutes a shot within the context of the game world. I know I've seen it work, but I've also seen it totally fail, so for me, this one remains a bit of an unknown. There is one additional upgrade, so to speak, that you can get if you open up the next chest in a given level after equipping the shield, but that specific item is specific to your second playthrough, so I'm not going to talk about that one just yet. And yes, I said second playthrough. More on that in a little bit. The thing is, the progression I just presented assumes that you haven't gotten hit at all while playing through a given level, which is honestly a pretty tricky thing to do much of the time. If you do get hit at some point, the chest progression is effectively reset. But not entirely, as the game actually trolls you a bit too, because it's also possible for a demon to spawn from the next chest you pick up after getting hit, whose sole purpose is to transform you into something, like a baby, that limits your ability to do much of anything other than move around slowly until you return to your normal form. Once you get used to the game's trollish nature, you can avoid and defeat the demon pretty easily, but the first couple times it happens to you, you will likely be a bit surprised. I should also mention, by the way, that weapons can also drop from various enemies that might be carrying container-like items, like pots. This can also totally troll you as well, because they might drop a weapon after you beat a given enemy that you don't notice until it's too late, getting rid of your preferred weapon in lieu of that new, most likely inferior, replacement weapon. You have no recourse when this happens, other than to hope your preferred weapon drops again in the near future. Which, by the way, is another reason why I mentioned that this game has a bit more slow-paced, almost strategic gameplay at its core. If you simply run through each level, you'll likely not maintain your preferred loadout, and as a result, your experience will become more difficult than it needs to be. And speaking of difficulty, yes, the game is very challenging, especially in the early going. From my perspective, most of this difficulty can be attributed to needing to learn the rhythm of the game, meaning how and when to jump, how and when to attack, when to stay still, when to go, and how to use your double jump as effectively as possible. The way each level of the game is presented to you is a mix of static elements, like where chests spawn, and more random kinds of situations, like where certain enemies spawn, and how many will charge you at any point in time. Most of the time, the best course of action when making your way through a level is to observe your enemies and progress slowly forward, rather than trying to be a one-man army and simply charge through endless hordes of bad guys. I can guarantee you, until you become very proficient at the game, a slower pace is the only way you'll ever hope to progress. So, assuming you adhere to this slower-paced kind of gameplay style, you'll likely begin to make some progress through the game. The next level of mastery that you'll need to unlock is how and when to best jump, which sounds like it'd be something relatively simple, but in Super Ghouls and Ghosts, it's actually a bit more complex than you might expect. In Super Ghouls and Ghosts, you have access to a double jump, which can be used to gain a bit of additional height to a leap, as you've likely seen in pretty much any other game that features a double jump mechanic. But here, there's actually a bit more to it than that, because the way you control your jump is decidedly more limited than many platform games. And by decidedly more limited, I mean that you can't control the direction of your jump at all after you initially leave the ground. Meaning, let's say you jump to the right. That jump is going to play out, in its entirety, without you being able to adjust its movement at all. You can't course correct, you can't reduce the jump's momentum, you can't realize, oh crap, I'm going to overshoot that platform, let me ease up on the acceleration. Actually, you can realize that last one, you just can't do anything to actually prevent yourself from overshooting that platform once you've initialized your jump. But, like I mentioned, you do have a double jump, and you can execute that second jump at any point in the arc of your first jump. And it is this mechanic that turns the game into something truly special. Now, I know some of you might be thinking to yourselves, how can a double jump turn a game into something special? Well, the thing is that this double jump mechanic, because of how it's implemented in the game, is what will allow you to pull off some pretty awesome, really amazing feeling maneuvers that you likely haven't considered possible in other platforming titles. But when you master the intricacies of the double jump here, you'll find that sections that you once thought impossible are now able to be navigated with deft precision, and enemy hordes that you once thought insurmountable can now be avoided simply by timing your double jumps at the right time of your first jump's arc, and potentially altering the direction of your original trajectory. Let me give you a few examples of why I truly believe the double jump mechanic here is so awesome once you get used to it. Let's say you're navigating a level, and you see a highly desirable item that is located right above a bottomless pit, so close to the pit that your normal jump would simply leap right over it. Well, if you jump once, let your body fall to retrieve the item, and then jump right after the item is picked up, you can land safely on the following platform with that desirable item now in hand. Or let's say there's a vicious enemy up ahead that you know is going to attack as soon as you show up on its radar. Well, you can jump forward, and then as soon as the enemy begins giving chase, you can jump in the opposite direction, making that enemy land where you would have otherwise landed had you not double jumped, leaving the enemy open to an undefended attack. Those and a number of other maneuvers are available once you become proficient with all of the intricacies of the double jump in Super Ghouls and Ghosts. Despite your best efforts at progressing through the game and taking your time to observe enemies and mastering the art of the double jump, I can guarantee you that you will die, and you will likely die often, especially as you're learning the game. Luckily, the game does have both a life and continue system, though the continues available to you are limited. That said, you can earn additional continues by collecting money bags scattered throughout each level, up to a maximum of 9 continues. These money bags are occasionally placed in out-of-the-way places that require some more advanced platforming to reach, which is another reason why learning to double jump effectively is definitely worthwhile. The way the money bags work is for each difficulty level in the game, you're required to collect a certain number of money bags in order to earn a continue. On easy, each stage will often have more than enough money bags for you to earn one or more continues without too much trouble, whereas on the hardest difficulty levels, you're going to need to put in a bit more effort in order to save up some continues. Here, though, is another spot where strategy might play a role, as every time you die, the money bags respawn. And there are certain stages with a good number of easily accessible money bags. So, depending on your playstyle and general risk aversion, you may decide to farm some money bags, killing yourself several times in order to respawn those money bags and accumulate continues. Is this 100% necessary? No, as once you become more proficient at the game, you're likely going to have a good chunk of continues available to you for the vast majority of your playthrough. But based on my own experience, it might be worthwhile to farm and bank some continues while you're learning the game, as it makes the process of learning the various stages much easier. And speaking of stages, the game is a relatively short experience, as there are only 7 stages in the game, along with a final boss fight stage that is literally just a boss fight, so it doesn't really count as a full-fledged level. Those 7 stages are pretty varied, though, and each stage itself is relatively large, with a single mid-level checkpoint providing an anchor point for continuing in the event you die. Assuming you make your way through a stage, you'll end up facing a boss fight, each of which are unique and designed with interesting mechanics at play. None other than the final couple bosses are particularly challenging, at least if you have the right weapons at your disposal, but they are diverse, and I enjoyed each boss fight that the designers included with the game. Now, I mentioned that the game is relatively short, and that's because a single playthrough just is not going to cut it if you want to truly beat the game. I suppose this could technically count as a spoiler, but the structure of the Ghosts and Goblins series is fairly well known at this point, so I'm going to take a risk. In Super Ghouls and Ghosts, just like every other game in the series, you actually have to beat the game twice in order to win the game. The first time through, you have carte blanche to play the game however you'd like, using whatever weapon you like. If you end up beating that first playthrough, The game will inform you that you need to retrieve a special item and return to the final boss fight in order to face the true big bad boss of the game. With that goal in mind, the game sends you back to the very first level of the game and lets you play the whole thing again, albeit at the next higher difficulty level than what you had originally picked. As an example, if you played your first playthrough at easy difficulty, your second playthrough will be at normal difficulty. If you played through your first playthrough using normal difficulty, your next playthrough will be on hard difficulty, and so on. For my playthrough, I did a normal run followed by hard, so I can only speak to the difficulty changes between those two categories. Overall, the second playthrough was roughly similar to the first, with the only major differences being the number of money bags to earn and continue, and the speed and density of several enemies in various stages. Things were certainly harder during the second playthrough, but not insurmountably so. I truly believe if you can beat the game once, you can beat the game a second time. The biggest issue from my perspective is the psychological fortitude needed to play through a fairly challenging experience a second time in succession. If you can get over that hurdle, you should be able to reach the final boss. And by the way, in order to reach that final boss, you need to retrieve a special item, which acts as a weapon from the chests in the game. Recall our discussion on chest progression in each level, with the highest chest progression item being a shield. Well, on your second playthrough, chests go one step further, as if you go to open a chest while you have a shield equipped, you'll reveal a bracelet, which is the secret item needed to make your way to the final boss and ultimately slay him. You 100% need this item in order to make it to the final boss fight, and if you try to get to him without the bracelet, you'll simply be forced to repeat a couple stages until you do in fact retrieve the bracelet. From my perspective, the bracelet is not really all that great of a weapon, so the way I usually handled this was to maintain my normal weapon loadout throughout most of the game, using the final stage as the moment to acquire the bracelet and ultimately use that bracelet for the remainder of the game. It will likely take you some time to get used to using the bracelet as opposed to whatever your favorite weapon is, so this is another reason why, if you can accumulate some continues, it should help you practice enough to become proficient with the bracelet as a weapon. All told, it took me around 15 hours of solid playing to eventually become good enough at the game to beat its two playthroughs as designed, without the use of any save states or other support options. This is a challenge I placed on myself, and is absolutely not required to enjoy the game. I would never judge anyone for making the experience a bit more user-friendly in this regard, as the game is tough, though it is, ultimately, a very worthwhile experience, regardless of how you play the game. We're going to talk more specifically about the different aspects of the game in just a minute, but first, as we always do, we have got to take a look at the back of the box, because, as you all know, I love looking at the back of the box for these games. I love learning how different companies marketed their titles, especially around this time, because we didn't have the internet. We didn't have YouTube with gaming videos. We didn't have always on and available access to information. Oftentimes, when we made a decision about what game to buy, we may have read a review in a magazine or two, but most of the time, it was based on what the box looked like in the store as we were standing in front of it. Did the front of the box look cool? If so, we'd flip it over and we would take a look at the back of the box. If the back of the box made the game sound great, we would often buy it. Otherwise, back on the shelf it would go. So, for Super Ghouls and Ghosts for the Super Nintendo, the back of the box says, Super Ghouls and Ghosts. Draw your sword. The quest begins. You are Arthur, the boldest bladesman alive. You are caught in a dangerous quest. Fiendish foes and grim demons are about to hurl disaster your way. You must save the wondrous Princess Guinevere, but beware. The reeking ruler of the Forbidden Land can call forth evil and destruction. Who knows what creeping, leaping terrors haunt this dripping realm. You may lose your armor and your strength. You may be hexed. You may become a baby, a duck, or a skeleton. But you are never without a weapon, and magic awaits to help you. Destroy the witches, ogres, and ghosts. escape the snapping skulls and ghastly ghouls, and save Guinevere from the mysterious depths of the Phantom Zone in Super Ghouls and Ghosts for one player. And then there are a few screenshots on the back of the box that show a couple of different stages, and I've got to say, the text on the back of the box sounds interesting, but it kind of sounds like traditional horror-esque themed fantasy fare. Nothing there that really sets the game apart from any other game that might be out there. But what I will say is that the images, the pictures of the game on the back of the box make the game look really good. And I've got to say that if I were looking at this game in the stores at the time, I did not buy this game, by the way, when I was younger, but I was aware of it. I hadn't actually bought it. But looking at the screenshots here, man, this is a pretty good looking Super Nintendo title. We're going to talk about that graphics or those graphics and everything else about the game as we move on. And actually, let's start by talking about the graphics. Like I was just saying, the game looks really good, with a large variety of character graphics, environmental details, and color palettes in use. I really did enjoy seeing the diversity present throughout the game, with the various enemy and boss designs in particular being a high point for me. Animations, similarly, were well done, though I would be remiss if I didn't call out some pretty heavy slowdown that occurred whenever the action on the screen was getting hot and heavy. This slowdown happened more times than I felt that it should have, though it never really detracted from the overall experience. It's simply something you should be aware of. The entire game is not a super smooth experience, and I can certainly see the potential for frustration related to the graphic slowdown that could, potentially, cause some unintended deaths. Overall, though, I thought the game looked really good, and is a solid example of a gothic, semi-spooky 16-bit platformer design. Moving on to the sound and music, I legitimately loved the music in the game, with every track being memorable and well composed. And it's a good thing the music is so good, because you will spend a lot of time listening to these tracks repeat as you figure out how to get past each stage. Despite the repetition driven by my own lack of skill, the music never grated on my nerves, which is sometimes a possibility when you listen to video game tracks for an extended period of time. Rather, I always felt that the music matched the action on the screen perfectly, and there was not a single moment where I considered that the music wasn't a contributing factor to my overall enjoyment of the game. Sound effects, meanwhile, are effective, though nothing really to write home about here. The true star of the auditory environment for Super Ghouls and Ghosts is the music, and in that regard, the game delivers. Moving on to the narrative and story, you play as the valiant knight Arthur, a heroic figure who has previously saved the realm from certain doom. It turns out that Emperor Sardius, a big bad guy with questionable morals, is at it again, having kidnapped Princess Guinevere and revived the ghoul realm, causing the dead to once again walk the earth. It is your job to rid the world of these foul demons, defeat Sardius' high-ranking minions, and ultimately defeat the big bad emperor himself, saving the princess and the kingdom in the process. So the story here is pretty standard fare for an action platform title, and I've got to say, it works. There was just enough lore and backstory to provide the motivation for your quest, and it never overwhelmed the true focus of the game, which was the overall gameplay. Overall, a solid story that I thought worked within the context of the game's world. And unlike what we were talking about on the back of the box, where the fact that it was a bit of a generic horror, gothic, fantasy kind of presentation, actually in-game and seeing how those elements worked within the confines of the game's overall structure, I've got to say it worked better in-game than what it did on the box, at least for me. Moving on to the playability and controls, we already talked a good deal about the overall structure of the game, so I'm not going to rehash all that here. But for completeness sake, the controls for Super Ghouls and Ghosts are pretty simple. You walk side to side using your directional pad, you can jump and double jump using your B button, you can swing, shoot, throw, and charge your weapon using the Y button, and you can duck by pressing down on the control pad. That, in a nutshell, is the control scheme for the game, and honestly, there isn't a whole lot of evolution beyond the Ghosts and Goblins framework that had been put in place years prior. A quick glance at the Super Nintendo controller reveals that more buttons are left unused than are actually used, which is an interesting data point, but ultimately not an indicator of quality, as I believe the controls for Super Ghouls and Ghosts are exactly the way they needed to be. Could they have been made a bit more complex, given the 16-bit power of the Super Nintendo Entertainment System? Well, sure, they could have been, but that would have almost felt like a deviation from the formula that made the game series so popular. So, ultimately, a simpler control scheme worked just fine for the game. And honestly, despite the simpler control scheme, there is a fair amount of depth here, as like we talked about, the variety of weapons at your disposal keeps gameplay feeling fresh, and the double jump mechanic in particular provides techniques that will ultimately improve your overall mastery of the game. Bottom line, the controls feel great, at least after you get used to them, because there is a definite learning curve here. I'm guessing you'll need around an hour of straight playing before you become accustomed to the game's controls and rhythm, which will then let you focus on the actual act of playing the game and learning its levels, enemies, and all of that good stuff. Until then, though, I would expect a bit of resistance. Overall playability of the title is of the decidedly old-school variety, with highly challenging levels and encounters without any hand-holding, and with only a minimal amount of assistance in the form of a limited but replenishable continue system. This is not the kind of game you pick up for a light gaming session, at least if you've never played the game before, because I'd wager a bet that you'll walk away frustrated. But if you want to devote some time to the title, I believe you'll come away feeling as though this game plays as well, if not better than, most other 16-bit action platformers out there, albeit while utilizing a unique spin on the action platformer formula and overall gameplay pace. I don't believe it controls or plays as well as modern games that may be retro-inspired, but for a truly old-school classic experience, there is a ton to like here. So overall, how did Super Ghouls and Ghosts feel to play? Well, it is one of those games that demands a lot out of its players, as the initial experience that you get playing the game is likely going to be something to the effect of, man, that is one hard game. But if you stick with it and meet the game's demands, you'll eventually find an experience with incredibly tight gameplay, satisfying mechanics, and well-balanced encounters that will continue to challenge you even after you've beaten the game a few times. Creating a game that remains engaging and challenging even after you've beaten it is a tricky thing to accomplish, but that's exactly what the designers behind Super Ghouls and Ghosts delivered, and once you get used to the unique flavor of gameplay mechanics at use in the title, you'll likely find yourself playing with a big smile on your face. So our overall verdict on Super Ghouls and Ghosts, well, the first thing I've got to say is that it is not the smoothest experience that we've had for this podcast, and it is certainly not the most approachable game we've covered. But if you take the time to develop your skills, you will eventually find a game that is difficult to put down, as you'll often find yourself whispering under your breath, "Just one more try," as you play into the later hours of the evening. Despite how engaging the game is, I recognize that it isn't for everyone, as it is definitely a challenging experience. But with that challenge comes great reward, and if you're willing to stand up to that challenge, I truly believe you'll walk away from the experience enriched for doing so. Which is why, for me, Super Ghouls and Ghosts deserves its spot as the newest member of our pantheon of classic gaming. Regardless of the difficulty, I truly believe everyone should give this one a go at some point in their gaming careers. Your overall enjoyment may be impacted by how well you respond to difficulty in gaming, but even here, you have some options, like setting the difficulty level lower, or utilizing save states, assuming you're emulating the game, that is. Regardless, I do believe everyone should try this title, and I further believe that the game is designed incredibly well, with difficult, but fair, gameplay throughout. Therefore, I do believe that Super Ghouls and Ghosts has earned its place in our pantheon of classic gaming. that was our episode on Super Ghouls and Ghosts. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT, I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. I highly encourage you all to check it out. I also highly encourage you all to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including an exclusive bi-weekly podcast expansion pack, patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday is where it's at. Before we sign off for the week, I do want to mention that our next episode is going to be focused on Raptor, Call of the Shadows, so feel free to write in if you have any particularly fond or not so fond memories of that experience. At the same time, I recognize you're likely listening to this podcast on any number of podcast engines, and if you would feel so inclined, it would be great if you could leave me a review. This is not about bolstering star counts. This is not about trying to harvest a ton of 5-star ratings, though if that happens, awesome, it means we're doing something right. No, what it's really all about is trying to deliver the best possible podcast I can. The only way to do that is to get feedback from all of you to make sure I am hitting the mark and delivering the content you all want to listen to. We get new listeners every single day, which is absolutely amazing. I want to continue to make sure I am delivering the best possible podcast that I can. We'll be back in around a week with our next episode focused on Raptor, Call of the Shadows. Until then, remember, sometimes the games of the past are just as good, if not better, than the games of today. Goodbye, everyone!